Hello, happy Pride, and welcome back to the Dorothy Project. I really hope you're all doing okay out there. If I'm honest, this whole pandemic thing really threw me for a loop back in March, which is why there's been a bit of a wait between the last episode and this one. But with it being Pride season, and a really important Pride season where our Black queer family are finally at the top of the gay agenda, it felt right to come back. Because it's been a while, here's what the Dorothy Project is all about. It's an interview podcast where I, DJ and activist Alice Beverton Palmer, get to celebrate women who are shaking up queer culture. Women like Charmaine Lovegrove. Charmaine is the founder of the publishing imprint Dialogue Books, which she set up to promote stories by, for, and about queer, disabled, working class, Black and minority communities. As a queer Black woman herself, Charmaine believes that storytelling creates the dialogue we need to build a more inclusive world. I quite agree. Her own life story is quite something, from homeless teenager to Berlin bookshop owner and now one of the leading lights of British publishing. She's also the first Black interviewee on the Dorothy Project. That's not a track record I'm proud of, and I'm determined to improve that ratio from now on. I started by asking Charmaine just how she is right now, because as we all know, 2020 is a lot.
Everyone's like, I've realised that my whiteness is problematic. And I'm like, yeah, but it's problematic you saying that. So just shut up.
Yeah, it's like, I never want to draw like direct comparisons, but I have found it interesting, some of the conversations like that I'm used to having with straight people about queerness. And like you were saying about the pride, and I'd be interested to know what you feel, but I thought like last week, I will be so sad if the only narratives that come out of this are people reading about trauma and you don't read about any of the joy and the culture, and that there's like this kind of sympathy and pity.
Yeah, it's wild. It's wild. You know, before we had this Black Lives, this new movement towards of Black Lives Matter, or sort of this extended movement that actually has been happening since I would say Haiti was like the first place to show real revolution. Before that, we've had Black women such as Nanny, who led a revolution in Jamaica to free Black people from the English, and they created a state and within Jamaica, and that's actually where it's called Cockpit Country, and that's where Usain Bolt's from Trelawney. And you know, it's really amazing, they don't pay taxes there, it's like a free state, and she was like a revolutionary in like the 1800s. So I'm like, listen, we're aware that we come from hundreds of years of like incredible people, and we stand on their shoulders and they lift us up. And so you can't tell us that our, I mean, what we're being told is just like, again, it's just this major gaslighting of like who we are, because actually I've always been told that was powerful. And before the movement started again, or like increased awareness again, then I've been teaching my son throughout the whole of lockdown about the Benin Empire, about different African countries and languages and kente cloth. And, you know, we've been talking about, I've been teaching him about African and Caribbean nations and the positive history. I only diverted our learning to the civil rights because of what was happening right now. So at 8 years old, you should be, it's a rite of passage to learn about where you're from. So everyone's coming to it late, and I get it, but I'm just like, listen and read. Buy the books, stop lending them to people, like actually buy the books. Every single book that is bought, that is counted, every time a book is scanned, it goes towards the author's earnings. The more we can show that these authors' books are valued and necessary, then the better their career will be. So buy the books, or lend them from your local library, but stop giving them to each other. It's you know, just read and think. And yeah, that's why I'm really super interested in, you know, I had this really amazing catch up with Layla Said yesterday, who wrote White Supremacy and Me. And you know, I was saying it's so great that everyone's reading your anti-racist books, but I really also wish they'd read the novels, because there's a centering of whiteness that's happening when you're doing the work. And when you're reading a novel, it's not about you. You're just reading about lives, and you can kind of separate yourselves. And that's really important. And her and I had this amazing discourse about it. And then she shared a post, and it's been wild. Like, she's such an incredible influence, such an important person. Same with Renée de Lodge, and, like, you know, people like Kimberly Crenshaw, who created the word intersectionalism. And, you know, the work that they do, and also Black Lives Matter. And it's like, the work that they do is so fundamental. So it's weird that people are coming to such powerhouses only now, but not everyone can be woke.
And, like, what do you think the role of, like, fiction has? Because I'm thinking about something like Pose, for example, on TV, has been this massive hit, and it's telling a story that has been around for so long, like Paris is Burning, that was made at the time. Like, what do you think it is about fiction that seems to connect with people so powerfully?
So one of my authors, Niven Govinden, wrote this book called This Brutal House, and it's about the ball community, it's about the mothers, and it's about their children who are disappearing. And one of the thing, and in New York City during the height of the ball period, and it really looks at what family is and what it means to kind of start again in your life and to be your true self. And there's lots of conflicts and there's protests, and it's a whole movement, and it's a really amazing book. And one of the things that he says, which I think is utterly profound, is that when you're a reader, you bring yourself to the reading. And one thing that we shouldn't always have to do is sort of explain, you know, what he's done with the ball culture is, like, he's not explaining what it is. He's giving you an example of a group of lives or of individuals that were living through that time. That's really important. He doesn't need to go back through the history of it in order for you to understand it. He just needs to tell us. And then you can go and watch Pose and Paris is Burning, et cetera, et cetera. Like, you can go and immerse yourself in that world. But it's so important to recognize what you bring yourself as a reader to any story, and to understand that these narratives are happening without you. And I think that's what's happening at the moment, is that people are realizing that there's these whole worlds that are being brought to the fore that were happening without them. And when you're white and you're used to being the center of everything, it's pretty shocking to realize that your views or your way of life, and, you know, is actually not the norm. And so that's what a lot of my writers bring, and that's why fiction is a really good way of thinking about your biases, but also just thinking about the stories of people that you've never met. And then once you've read those stories, I feel like you come out to the world a bit, like, anew, afresh. You kind of think, when you walk down the street, you suddenly realize that all these people have a plethora, multitude, and nuanced lives that you've never considered. And I think that's what's so brilliant about fiction.
LGBTQ stories are obviously a key part of what you do there. And had you specifically worked on queer culture before? Like, what had been your connection to it?
So I identify as queer. I'd spent most of my life with women, and then I met my husband, and we have a child, but being queer is, like, a very important part of my identity, so, you know, that thing of intersectionalism, you know, is just very clear to me. And also, what I didn't want to do is, I didn't want to just, because I'm so aligned to so many different groups and I understand minority culture, then unlike white feminism, which has only brought up white feminism, it's very clear to me that if I was going to do this, I need to bring everybody up with me. We all come up together, and that's how you create equality. And so it was one thing identifying with the LGBTQIA plus community, and it's a different thing to represent with the Black community and other minority ethnic communities. But although I'm not disabled myself, and although I'm not working class, I know that there's huge issues with representation. So why not bring everybody together into a space and to give all of those voices the chance to be equal, as opposed to being ghettoized as like a Black or queer imprint?
I was going to ask you, like, what would be, if you had like a reading list for people for Black queer authors for Pride Month, what would you put on people's bookshelf right now?
Okay, so I've got some books here. The first book would definitely be Rainbow Milk by Paul Mendes. My copy's upstairs, but there's the front cover. This is probably one of the most intersectional books that you could read. It's about a gay young man called Jesse who's from a Jehovah Witness community, and he is sort of expelled from the church for being gay and goes to London and becomes a sex worker. And it's unbelievable, this book. I've just published The Vanishing Half. Not only is it a story about race and two sisters who live divergent lives, they're twins and they pass as white, and one of them leads a life as a white woman and the other as a Black woman. And then you see the next generation. In the next generation, one of the children of the twins, who is very dark Black, which is very important, she starts a relationship with a trans man. So again, we are seeing like the most sort of intersectional stories. I've got like a whole pile of books here.
From I love my it.
Personal reading list.
Wow. So
move them over. So these are like, you know, these are books from my own home that I'm reading all the time. Obviously, Girl, Woman, Other, our amazing queen, Bernadine, you know, like she's just phenomenal. And this book, absolutely, I've never felt so seen as a Black British woman. Bernadine was influential in the Black theatre seen as a queer woman, as a lesbian in the 80s. And, you know, this book, really the 12 lives of women and with an ex and charting 100 years, and each chapter 12 voices. Phenomenal book. Here Comes the Sun by Nicole Dennis-Benn. It's about a young Black, they're Jamaican, and they are living in the midst of gentrification of their area, and they're sort of trying to find themselves and live as Black. When you're not a minority, it's very different. So they're living as Jamaicans, and sort of, and in Jamaica, homosexuality is illegal. And so it's just about the nuances of that, whilst also the complexities of colorism and lightness and all of that. I mean, this is a really astounding book. I met Nicole in Jamaica and read her book on the plane home, and then have just massively like been inspired by her. I just think she's an amazing writer, and she's got a second book out called Patsy. So we're going backwards in time. So then you go to Difficult Women by Roxane Gay, and you know, it's just a really powerful book. And again, it's very intersectional, talking about being gay, talking about mental health, talking about being a woman, and so it's a really intersectional feminist book. Then you go to James Baldwin, and you do more James Baldwin, and Audre Lorde, you know, really, really important. I'm really glad that Silver Press brought this out. I've been reading Audre Lorde since I was a teenager, and so really pleased to finally like hear her voice again coming more into a wider society. And also writers like Bell Hooks, you know, just really, really important queer people. And, you know, then you can go right back to like the Harlem Renaissance and be reading Their Eyes Were Watching God. There's so many books that were written around the Harlem Renaissance that are super, super, super important, because that was a time in which Black people in Harlem in the 30s could absolutely live their lives as free people. And the intersectionalism of queer, but also Black activism, you know, Marcus Garvey, you know, the fur coats, the life. I mean, it was amazing. It was amazing, that period. And the writing that came from there, from people like Langston Hughes and Nella Larson and Zora Neale Hurston, was phenomenal and really, really important to our canon. And all of those kinds of stories and writers contain queer narratives at the heart with Blackness. So we've been doing this for time. For time. So that's what I mean. I'm like so excited that people can come to it now, that they're going to have a new audience and a new readership, and that people are going to understand that actually it's really fucking amazing to be Black, and it's really incredible to be queer, and yes, it's really difficult, and yes, we face massive challenges, but that's better than being mediocre and stuck.
What do you think that like storytelling does that other, like at the moment, obviously everyone's out on the streets, like people are agitating in Parliament. Like, what does storytelling do that other things can't to drive progress?
So, as I said, with Layla, when we were talking yesterday, Layla said what we were discussing was the fact that storytelling allows you to sort of remove yourself as the center of the book. So you are not the protagonist. You're not having to do the work as a reader. You just read. And when the writing is flawless, then it's an effortless thing. And so when you immerse yourself in any story written by anybody that is excellent, then what you're doing is you're creating a sense of empathy in yourself. It's like, I don't know if there's ever been any studies in this, but I'd love to know if someone's worked out if there is a chemical that happens, you know, like an oxytocin, like is there something that's released when you're reading, that is there a chemical reaction that creates empathy? In the way that it does with love, or when you're having sex, or, you know, there's all these at all times, you know, pheromones. So I don't know if there's ever been a study. So I'd love to know if anyone could let me know.
Please, I'm going to look that up.
But
that needs to know.
I know. Well, I'm just thinking of it now. Like, what's, there must be a thing, but it creates an empathy. And so what that does is that leads to your earlier question of like, why I set up dialogue in the way that I did, is because I'm empathetic with other groups who are marginalized outside of my own experience. And so once you start seeing the world outside of your own experience, which is what fiction specifically allows you to do, allows you to kind of get lost in that, then you can take to the streets, and you can talk to your bosses and at work, and you can advocate for change because you've understood the complex nuances of individual lives where you haven't centered yourself. And that is like, that's a gift. You know, there's a philosophy book called The Gift. Let me have a look and see who wrote that. I can't remember who wrote it. There was a book by Lewis Hyde. Yeah, that's it. And how the spirit of how the creative spirit transforms the world. But there was a book also by a philosopher whose name has gone out of my head, unfortunately, but a French philosopher from like many, many years ago.
One of them.
But he was writing about the gift from a sort of, oh, is it Levi Strauss? It might be Levi Strauss, actually. The gift. Levi Strauss wrote this book called The Gift, and it was like the form and reason of exchange in archaic societies. And it was written in 1925. And basically it was sort of looking at how we gift each other as human beings, and that sort of state of empathy. And that's also what Lewis Hyde is referring to as like an updated version. So the point is that these writers are giving us a gift of knowledge, and that's what we get from fiction, and that's what we get from these experiences. And in exchange, you give us as publishers and as storytellers, the gift of your time. And I see that as like a fundamental exchange between people. You give the gift of time to read, because it takes a long time to read. We give you the gift of story, and which then enacts empathy, which then should enact action.
Something that I ask like everyone I interview is what their first experience of a queer space was. Where were they? What was the first place they went?
So I was really lucky that I grew up in Battersea in Southwest London, so really central. And, you know, the area that is adjacent to Battersea is Clapham. And it's really funny because everyone's always like, oh, but you're not from Clapham or Brixton. And I'm like, but when you grow up in London, you don't just stay in Battersea and then not move out of it. Like, you don't just stay in your area and then you're like, I can't come up to the common today at the top of my road because I'm actually only from Battersea. It's like, but I imagine that if you live in the countryside or you live in small towns, then it's quite hard to imagine that you're just moving around the whole city in the way that we did. You know, I was in Camden most weekends from the age of 11. So my first experiences, actually, it's interesting that Rainbow Milk kind of touches on older gay, white gay men that live in townhouses. Live in townhouses in Clapham. And me and my friends, when we were probably 13, 14, would meet various men. And actually they were Irish. And so they understood like the troubles, and they understood, they'd had like a huge, you know, they understood ACT UP. They really spoke to us about HIV and AIDS, and basically they had a lot of life experience, and we just would go around to their houses and like have cocktails and take drugs and have a really good time. And it was amazing. And it was so funny because although I didn't know Paul Mendes, my author of Rainbow Milk then, when I first read his manuscript, I was like, wow, I was really there. Like, that was my childhood, you know, like meeting these amazing men, like the character Torsten and his husband in Rainbow Milk, and them educating us and then telling us about queer history and them really kind of bringing this sort of activist notion. So my best friends, there's like four of us that grew up in this space. And so for us, it was never a question. Like, our queerness was never a question because we knew what had come before. We knew how hard it was before, and we felt so lucky. Like, we never really had to come out. We just were us. And then obviously there were loads of gay bars and I mean to grow up in London, specifically in Southwest, and being able to walk to gay clubs, not just in Clapham but also to GAY, like we could walk there. So it was always just a huge part of our lives. And then I moved to Hackney in 1999 and I was 18. And then, you know, my friend, so one of my best friends, Hannah Holland, you know, she's like a really important electro flash DJ. You know, she played her first gig ever when I lived on a boat in Battersea, you know, and we were at the very beginning of this Shoreditch electro scene, and we had our own club nights, and we went to Batty. Oh, she had her night was Batty Bass, and there was Golf Sale, and like, oh my god, you know, we just. So for me, it's like I've never not. I've never not known a life without it. And even when I was younger, although I'm estranged from my parents had a lot of gay friends and a lot of black gay friends as well, who would come to our house for dinner. And, you know, I mean, it wasn't, I've never been separate from that world. And so maybe that's why I'm doing the work that I do, because it was only later that I was like, oh, so if you come from this place, like Nuneaton, you've had to really struggle, you know, like you've really had to struggle. And that's really, really hard. And you know, if you come from an estate in Glasgow and being ostracized, and, you know, when you talk and listen to someone like Damien Barr, and you're like,
yeah,
wow, that struggle is very, very, very real, you know. And thank God, you know, so it's not an accident that places like all these people end up coming to cities like London, because I know, I understand why, because I grew up in it, and I know what we were there to do. I know that gay pride is something that I went to with my family on Cup and Common when I was already like 8-9 years old. So that was a very long way of me saying that I've never had a life without queerness.
I'm obsessed with Charmaine. You can find all of her book recommendations, the Dream Pride reading list, on our Twitter feed right now. We're at @Dorothy_podcast. Don't forget to let us know what you thought and who you think I should interview next.
I'll be back in 2 weeks' time with another absolute goddess to bless your ears and your day. See you then.